Welcome to the Research Reimagined podcast, brought to you by Nottingham Trent University. I'm your host, Helen Darby Dowman, and I'll be inviting some of NTU's brightest minds to explore how their research is helping us to deepen our understanding of the world. From online addictions to transgender rights and sleep disorders, listen as we discuss some of society's most pressing challenges and uncover some of the ways our research is making a difference. General elections take place every 5 years in the UK. On election day, registered voters in each constituency vote for their preferred candidate to become their local MP, either by showing up to the polling station or posting their votes in advance. After the votes have been counted, the King asks the leader of the party with the most MPs to become the new Prime Minister and to form a government. But who decides when the elections take place, and what tactics do candidates use to try and win our votes? To help answer some of these questions today, I'm joined by two researchers from the School of Social Sciences here at Nottingham Trent University, Tom Cagill, Senior Lecturer in Politics, and Matthew Mokefi Ashton, Principal Lecturer in Politics and International Relations. Tom, Matt, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting us.
Oh, thank you for having us.
So Tom, can you start off by telling us about how a general election actually works?
Of course. So the very first kind of question we come to here is, well, who calls it, when will it be? Well, that power resides in the hands of the Prime Minister. Parliaments have to can last no longer than 5 years, but the Prime Minister has the power via the royal prerogative to call an election as and when they see fit. I guess the next question then is, well, okay, so how does this election ultimately operate? Well, of course, there is a national campaign, but Parliament is made up of 650 members. So there are 650 individual constituencies, and as a result, 650 localised elections taking place at once, under a kind of wider umbrella of a national campaign. So we have a system that we call First Past the Post, and it's one we utilise across the entirety of the UK for Westminster elections. And the basis really is that in each of those individual constituencies, the person with the most votes wins. So, you know, you can get into a situation where you've got kind of a marginal seat where it could be a three-way marginal, so there's three different parties contesting it with a chance of winning. So actually sometimes, you know, if we're looking at kind of the total share of votes in that seat, someone can be elected with, say, 35% of the votes, despite, 65% of the population in that seat having voted for somebody else. It doesn't matter. It's whoever wins the most votes in that seat, regardless of how many candidates there are. If they win the most votes, they win.
So how do parties typically try and persuade people to vote for them? And what are we likely to see?
So there's a range of different ways that they try to talk to the public. There's the old-fashioned way of going around to the doorstop, knocking on doors, putting leaflets through, trying to have one-to-one conversations with people. And that often can be quite effective, you know, that face-to-face kind of quality. The trouble is, it is very, very resource-intensive. You need a lot of people on the ground, and a lot of that depends on how well the party is doing. If the party is ahead in the polls, then generally volunteers are saying, yep, we're up for this, you know, we want to win. If the party is very far behind in the polls, then it's very hard to get people enthusiastic about going out, you know, in the wind and the rain, trying to have conversations with people who don't want to talk to them. There's also going to be billboards all over the place, party political broadcasts, which quite often people don't watch because they're on quite late at night and can sometimes be a little bit dull. There's also going to be, I think, social media is going to play a huge role. The advantage that social media has over, you know, traditional advertising is that relatively it is quite cheap. You know, you can put out hundreds of sort of, you know, tweet adverts or on TikTok or YouTube relatively cheaply compared to other forms of advertising. But also, really importantly, you can personalise it. You know, you've got no control over who may see a billboard or who doesn't. But with social media, you can say, okay, we only want this to appear on the Facebook pages of men under the age of 25 or people living in a certain geographical area. And that's going to be really important this time round because there's a lot of new young people who are going to be voting for the first time. Traditionally, political parties have found it quite difficult to reach out to young people, or young people aren't that keen on voting. So I think both parties are going to put a lot of money, time and effort into social media, trying to find issues that young people care about, they can reach out to them on.
One of the other things we'll see in addition to that, and is television debates, a relatively new feature of British democracy. We've only really seen them taking place since 2010. I wouldn't say they're a fixed part of election campaigns, because every year they've kind of evolved and changed shape depending on what the Prime Minister and Leader of Opposition want to do. So they're not the same as the kind of TV debates that we will see every presidential election in the US. They're not quite that entrenched here. But the things that we're kind of starting to hear from the political parties are that the Conservatives want to go for as many as they can possibly get. They're behind in the polls, and they haven't got, you know, there's not much to lose at this point. So they want to kind of get Rishi Sunak out there as much as they possibly can, to kind of, you know, show kind of competent kind of prime minister, competent leader, you know, has a track record of being in office for over a year now as well. Whereas Labour, they're ahead in the polls. Obviously, they've got more to lose. You know, I'm not saying, you know, saying either one of them will do well or badly, but, you know, if Keir Starmer were to take part in, what, five debates and mess up on the third, well, that hits Labour's poll ratings. They've got much more to lose in that particular regard. And from what I've kind of read and heard in the media, Labour are looking for around, you know, happy to take part in two, but, you know, aren't really interested in doing any more than that as well. So alongside the kind of leadership debates, again, we almost becomes quite presidentialised in that when almost two different campaigns are being run, the kind of localised campaigns, you know, knocking on doors that Matt mentioned, 650 localised campaigns versus a national campaign, which obviously then becomes very leadership focused as well. And we saw that in 2019, Boris Johnson kind of, you know, asking people in the street, how are you voting in 2019? Oh, I'm voting for Boris Johnson. Unless you're voting in his constituency, technically you weren't. But it kind of just goes to show you that, again, it has become a little bit more kind of leadership-centred, prime ministerial, presidentialised in that kind of way. And we might also see some debates on policy areas. So it has become a little bit more popular now for kind of the Chancellor, Shadow Chancellor, to kind of tee off against each other in terms of the economy. We might see something on the issues of immigration, given how important it's been kind of centrally, not just for the government, but for the public, have, you know, rated it in their top five political issues that they're interested in. As once again, we'll have the kind of wider national campaigns taking place ultimately as well.
So with the debate, you mentioned that obviously Conservatives are keen to have lots, but Labour don't want them. Who actually gets to decide that?
I mean, this is interesting because actually in the US there is a commission on presidential debates that negotiates between the two parties. In Britain, we haven't got that. It's literally a negotiation between television producers and the party leaders. So it could be a case of Keir Starmer, you know, it's true that Labour want two, saying, right, okay, Sky News, BBC, right, yep, we'll have one in each of you. And then it's really up to other channels, if they want to have debates too, to kind of call Labour's bluff and say, right, we're holding a debate. We'll empty chair you. So almost it becomes a debate and discussion, and, you know, they may square off against each other. I mean, I can see the likelihood of some news channels being more willing to kind of push the boat on that than others. You know, public broadcasters maybe less likely to know platform a leader, potentially if that person could potentially become prime minister in a few weeks' time. Other news channels, which are more commercial, might have less reticent, you know, not be scared to try and kind of push the boat out on that one and say, right, yeah, we will literally empty chair you in this debate. We'll invite all of the party leaders, but your chair will be left vacant. So that is a potential as well. But yeah, there's no otherwise, there's no mediating force in this apart from party leaders, their campaign advisors, and the television producers themselves.
Matt, when did the last general election take place? And tell us a little bit about what's happened since then.
So the last election took place 5 years ago in 2019. And I think it's fair to say that this has been one of the most eventful parliaments, certainly in my lifetime. You've got the Brexit negotiations that were finalised under Boris Johnson. You then had the terrible COVID pandemic that impacted the entire country, the entire planet, for the best part of 2 years. You saw Boris Johnson leaving due to Partygate and various scandals. We then saw a new Prime Minister, Liz Truss, and her budget, and being forced out of power after only 44 days, and then Rishi Sunak. And while this was going on, also the invasion of Ukraine, various events in the Middle East and elsewhere. So it's been a very, very disruptive five-year period with the impact on energy prices and the economy and so forth.
Yeah, and I think it's quite incredible how the landscape has changed in the last 5 years, because, you know, Boris Johnson came into office in 2019, or re-came into office in 2019, with an 80-seat majority. You know, he was 10 seats, well, in that election, what, 10 other seats had changed hands? That we would have been talking about a landslide, victory of 100-seat majority. And, you know, if you'd asked me in 2019, I think I did say to my students in 2019 that the likelihood would be the Conservative Party's in office for another 2 terms of office, because it's incredibly difficult to overturn an 80-seat majority in one go. The fact that we're talking about, given on current polling, you know, Labour landslide majorities of over 100 seats, I mean, these will be some of the biggest swings we've seen in modern history towards Labour and against a governing party. And again, nobody foresaw the kind of almost kind of self implosion of Boris Johnson around Partygate occurring. And I think that's where, you know, Boris Johnson is kind of is where the tide turned. And, you know, right up until around 2021, 2022, the Conservative Party were in the lead, polling-wise, a good 9-10 points ahead of Labour. Now we're in a position where they're behind by an average 20 points. That's, you know, it's been incredibly stable over the course of the last 12 months. Like, nothing has kind of shifted. Not the King's Speech, party conference, budgets, autumn statements. Nothing has moved the dial. Again, I would not have expected that at all 5 years ago. I think the other kind of big transformation too is, and I think it reflects at least some of the chaos of the last 5 years, is actually that 80-seat majority, which incredibly healthy majority, again, on the tip of being a landslide, has now been cut to around 43 seats, which again, a result of the kind of sleaze and scandals that Matt mentioned as well. And in some ways, actually, the 2019 Parliament might not be remembered quite so fondly in historical terms based on some of the chaos that Matt mentioned and the sleaze around it too, despite, you know, getting Brexit done. And that, you know, that being kind of a key mantra is what the 2019 election was all about, a big achievement for Boris Johnson. Just unfortunately, the rest of the kind of final 3 years of office have been undermined by Partygate, the downfall of Liz Truss, sleaze and scandal, which, you know, has dogged Rishi Sunak's government as well. Even on weeks where it's looked like the government's, you know, back on message, doing a really good job, the economy's improving, something new comes out of the woodwork. It's like we're back to square one again of having to kind of defend sleaze and scandal.
And a big part of this is the role of the media. Once the media feel there's a particular momentum or a particular narrative, it's very hard to break out of that. Once the media decide we want to talk about the negative stuff, it's very hard to get them to change their minds after a certain point.
So do you think there is actually positives to come out of the last 3 years that, you know, obviously has been so negative? And now obviously we've got this major, you know, the polls are showing that Labour are up massively. Like, is there a positive side to it that we should be hearing about?
Well, I was going to say about COVID. You know, the fact the vaccine was rolled out so incredibly quickly, developed and rolled out very, very quickly. And also, I think Sunak doesn't necessarily get enough credit for the financial support put into the system in terms of, you know, keeping businesses going, keeping individuals going. And there's always going to be people who say he could have done more. But I think, you know, that's something where he should get a lot of credit for.
Yeah, you know, and you know, the economy and the government is saying it is starting to turn a corner. The growth forecasts in the next few years are looking a bit more healthy, back towards the kind of annual target of 2% that we'd seen in the previous decade or so before inflation is coming down. I think the problem the government has, and although they control the timing of the election, is that positive news have been getting, can take time to filter through to the average person in the street. So yes, inflation's coming down, but that doesn't mean prices are going to go down. That price pressure maintains. The price increase is just going to go up slowly, more or less fast than they had been over the previous 12 months. I think there is a risk here for the government in terms of the messaging around that positivity. I think this is, you know, I kind of almost feel sorry for them in a way, because, you know, the economy is improving. It's something that you would normally be championing and shouting from the rooftops about. But I think because we've been in such a difficult cost of living crisis, the messaging has to be so careful, because, you know, we've got two, again, not to kind of criticise them personally, we've got two, you know, it's a fact that they're both incredibly wealthy men. And if they're both turning around saying, everything's on the up, it's all getting better, but that's not being reflected with the public, that can paint them as out of touch and actually do more damage to their brand than perhaps, you know, the benefits of an improving economy ultimately bring us as well.
I mean, one of the things here is the fact the government, I would argue, has been doing some very good work with Ukraine. Boris Johnson and his successors have actually been very, very popular and have gotten a lot of credit abroad for the work they're doing supporting Ukraine. The trouble is, at the moment, the British public are more concerned with home issues, bread and butter issues around sort of cost of living. So that's kind of ignored or swept under the carpet a bit.
Yeah, and I think to some degree, so those achievements have been undermined by the kind of sleaze and scandal, and again, you know, can't help but kind of feel sorry politically for them. There are things that they can cheer about, but actually, again, I think some degree the public have, because of those sleazy scandals, have stopped listening. And, you know, when we talk about the polling not shifting for 12 months, I think that's evidence that, you know, even a cut in national insurance, which has happened twice now, hasn't moved, you know, 4% cut in national insurance, X number of hundreds of pounds a year better off for the average person, it's not really, it hasn't moved the dial at all. So even if they are interested in home issues, I think actually they're just not listening to the government at all. And I wonder actually whether the damage was done under Liz Truss, and that we just haven't been able to move on from that, really. And that's the point, maybe the point at which the public did switch off and stop listening to them.
So in 2010 we had a hung parliament. From listening to obviously this conversation, I'm assuming you're not thinking that's a likely outcome.
No,
I would be incredibly surprised. I mean, it'd blow the eyebrows off me if that were to occur. I mean, you know, when students ask me this question all the time in my British politics, you know, when's the election going to be? What's the result going to be? And, you know, I've always been quite tentative. You know, we're still a way off. It could be, you know, it could be called at any time. But, you know, I don't see it not being a Labour majority. It's just a question of how big that majority is right now. But bar some kind of massive implosion within the Labour Party, which I guess, you know, perhaps the Conservative Party is hoping for, given that, again, as I said, you know, in terms of chess moves, there aren't many good moves left. It's only really for the other side to collapse and fail. But again, I just don't see. Yeah, if your hopes are relying upon your opponent slipping up and messing up in such a catastrophic way, again, it doesn't really present a really positive picture, does it?
I think Labour are being quite clever strategically at the moment, where I think it was Napoleon who said, "Don't interrupt your enemies when they're making a mistake." Labour, a lot of the time here, are just sort of sitting back, and while the Conservatives are engulfed in this kind of scandal chaos, just letting them get on with it, rather than trying to sort of interrupt this narrative or, you know, try and talk about the stuff they want to talk about.
Could you take me through, I guess, what will actually happen in the run-up and those 48 hours surrounding the election? Can you just explain the steps?
Yeah, so the first step really will be Rishi Sunak kind of standing on the steps of Downing Street, which has kind of become tradition, basically saying, right, I'm off to the palace, I'm going to ask the king to dissolve Parliament, and we're going to hold an election on this this set day. Immediately after that, he will leave Downing Street, head to the palace, meet with the king, and will formally declare Parliament will be dissolved on a certain date, at which point then Parliament has normally maybe a week and a half max, if that, to get any last remaining business through, any legislation going through that the government wants on the statute books before Parliament ultimately dissolves. And then at that point, Parliament essentially ceases to exist. It has been fully dissolved. There are no members of Parliament anymore. They're all sent off to go and campaign. Peers are sent off, obviously, to go and campaign. So we do get into the kind of full campaign at that point. Party leaders travelling around the country, particularly visiting those marginal seats that are going to be key to building a majority in the next Parliament in particular. Scattered amongst those 25 working days will be a series of interviews, a series of debates that are taking place, as well the ones I mentioned before in terms of kind of leadership debates. There may also be the kind of wider policy-based debates with kind of cabinet, shadow cabinet members. Well, we have seen that in the past, particularly around the economy. I think in 2010, Channel 4 held a kind of economics-based debate with George Osborne, who was then the shadow chancellor, and the late Alistair Darling, who was Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time as well. So yeah, the attention really then focuses away from Westminster and actually to the country at large. The conversations that are happening on the doorsteps, the kind of national campaigns, in terms of TV adverts, billboards, the party leaders, and that kind of wider kind of presidential, I guess, in inverted commas, style of campaign that we're going to see as well. As we get closer to polling day itself, there will be kind of a ramping up of activity, particularly with activists on the ground, door knocking, leafleting. Again, this will tend to happen more frequently in marginal constituencies. Again, the way our electoral system works, it does mean that there is a handful, maybe a third of seats in Westminster that do make or break elections. That's where most of the kind of intense activity will take place. So it'll be door knocking, parties will be trying to identify where their voters are, and who they need to knock on election day itself and get out to vote. And I think, yeah, the final part of that is that kind of get out to vote operation. So yeah, the whole kind of five-ish weeks beforehand, it's a case of identifying where your voters are, trying to convince people into the kind of Conservative camp or the Labour camp, so you can mark it on your spreadsheet and say, yep, they're saying they're going to vote for us now. And yeah, the campaigning day itself, or the couple of days beforehand, it's about knocking on many doors as the parties possibly can and saying, A, are you aware the election is today, tomorrow? Are you going to vote? Is there anything we can do to help get you out to vote? So sometimes, you know, parties do put on kind of taxi bus services to get people to the polling station if they do have problems getting there as well. The one thing we will notice on election day itself, there'll be virtually no coverage on the news of any kind of campaigning activity. The only news until 10 o'clock will be there is an election happening. That will be it. They don't talk about there is a very strict rules around TV broadcasting, which we do not talk about kind of party campaign pledges, issues on polling day itself. That is a day of choosing for the public, and the public are left to make those decisions for themselves. What we will see at 10 o'clock, as soon as polls close, is an exit poll. Normally, again, waiting on Sky News, BBC News tends to be the main one, and we'll find out really just how the parties have fared. And those exit polls have mostly been fairly accurate in terms of the final result.
So it's live data, is it, that's coming into that poll that then basically shifts it and it's going against predictions?
Exactly, yeah. So if you watch election night coverage on the BBC, on Sky News, the presenter will regularly cut away to the kind of data analysis during the course of the night. The likes of John Kurtz, who we've mentioned before, often leads the BBC coverage. I suspect he will be for the selection. So yeah, he'll be talking about the results that have come in, how that fares up against the prediction in the exit poll, and then that poll will be adjusted to identify, okay, it's what, 1 o'clock in the morning, this is where we think things stand right now based on the results that we've had.
Because obviously people can vote via the post, or they can actually go into the polling stations. How do they kind of deal with that, if you just talk about the practical level of, you know, dealing with those votes coming in? Because obviously it stops at 10 o'clock and then it's that rush, isn't it? We always hear about we're the first area to announce, you know, where is the first?
Sunderland.
It's always Sunderland.
Always Sunderland. They rehearse this manically to make sure that they are the first. And this happened, you know, I remember during the Brexit referendum, that was the very first result to come in, and it showed the way things were heading right from the off. What, 2 hours maybe after polling had closed, we kind of knew, oh, okay, the Remain campaign is in trouble already, and we've only had one kind of area of the UK ultimately identified. I mean, that is not necessarily the case when it comes to general elections. Of course, we would expect Sunderland to stay Labour. It's like, it tends to be, well, I say safe seat. I think it's one parts of the red wall that didn't quite fall to Boris Johnson in 2019, but didn't come far off falling. But you know, it will be, you know, will be an early measure of, okay, just how big of a swing have Labour got here? You know, even the seat that Labour held, how big of a swing in those kind of seats have they already started to amount? And you know, that will obviously then have an impact in terms of, okay, what might the marginal seats look like on that basis ultimately as well. But in terms of the kind of postal votes, I mean, you know, there is a deadline at which you've got to hand them in. If you miss that deadline of getting it in the post, you can drop it off at a ballot station, polling station. Basically, as soon as 10 o'clock hits, they will start counting those postal ballots, even before the main boxes have come in, because the council already have hold of them. They're just ready to be opened and start counting. So they're often the very first votes to be counted before the actual ballot boxes themselves arrive from polling stations around the constituency, around the wider council area as well.
And I was going to say, one of the big things happening during the month of the election campaign that's going to be massive this time around, I think, is Labour going out downplaying their chances of victory. Because the biggest problem sometimes, if you're really ahead in the polls, is supporters thinking, well, Labour are going to win by a massive majority, I don't need to vote. So if on the day it's tipping it down with rain or really cold or just looks generally unpleasant, there's a real risk of people staying home. So Labour will be out there saying, oh no, the polls are wrong, it's a lot closer than it looks, you know, it could go either way. And they'll be really pushing that narrative as strongly as possible. And also the thing that Tom was saying about making sure that people are registered to vote and eligible to vote and have the right paperwork, because that's a big concern this time round.
So obviously exit polls, Then we'll have the actual counting of the votes, announcements. So then tell us a little bit about what will happen. So post-election, how will the government move forward? What will we see?
So, I mean, we'll normally get an announcement fairly up in the early hours of the morning. We'll have an idea of who has won. The scale of victory will probably be in sight, but again, we'll probably wait until the Friday afternoon, evening, until the final polling stations have counted. Some decide not to count until the Friday morning, but most do count on the Thursday, even given the importance of national elections. So we will see a winner declared, and they may well declare it themselves quite early on, or even perhaps a loser might come out quite early on and say, yeah, look, it's going to be a very bad night. They might declare the election kind of lost quite early on, depending on the scale of the victory or defeat, depending on which argument you're looking at. Then the focus then turns to, okay, we have a new government coming into office, potentially. So if it's a Conservative Party, well, Rishi Sunak will stay on in Downing Street, so there'll be kind of, I guess, less kind of pomp and fanfare around it, because, well, he'll already be in return back from Conservative headquarters back to Downing Street, so maybe a little victory party on the kind of Downing Street itself with activists. But it'll be nothing compared to what we see when there is a change of government, because, of course, you've got brand new activists coming who are very hyped. They've been in opposition for a number of years, and the kind of fanfare around it tends to be quite much larger. So again, if Labour do win, you'll see Keir Starmer walking down the street, walking down the street towards Number 10, people shouting, cheering, flags waving, a whole hullabaloo kind of being made of the process. We'll then likely at some point on Friday start to hear who. At least the big beasts will be in cabinet. So the kind of big cabinet positions, particularly the big four. So around who's going to take the role of Chancellor, Foreign Secretary, Home Secretary, Defence, Justice, etc. And then we'll start to see the kind of more junior members of the cabinet, ministerial ranks fulfilled over the course of probably the weekend into Monday, just to get the new government in position. At some point during the course of the dissolution announcement, at the start of the election, there will be a royal proclamation stating when the new parliament will be called. So that date will be more or less fixed in writing. We do see it on the, I think I was in Edinburgh for when one of the calls was made last time. We hear the royal heralds kind of fanfare shouting, the king commands that parliament meet on such and such a date. So that'll be in the diary. It's already preset. So immediately once we get a cabinet in position, minister in position. We'll see the election of a speaker. So it could be re-election of Lindsay Hoyle, or if he decides to stand down or is contested. And we'll see that take place. Very first thing the monarch asks Parliament to do, or the Commons to do, is to elect a speaker. Once speaker's in place, then we'll see the swearing in, parliamentary oath being delivered. And again, that can take a little bit of time, because again, you've got 600 MPs going through the process, 650 MPs rather, going through the process, and they all re-swear upon re-election. As well, so that can take some time. And again, within that, Parliament will also start kind of ramping up its processes too. So we'll start seeing questions starting to arise. Okay, how do we get the Select Committee set up? Are there being any changes to the machinery of government that Parliament needs to reflect as well? So we'll have at least probably a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks of getting everything set up ready for the new government to hit the ground running, at least from a legislative perspective, for those first 100 days of wider honeymoon period.
So those first 100 days then, as a nation, we should expect to see quite meaningful change for the things that we're voting for?
Well, meaningful announcements, hopefully. I think one of the big things, problems with politics from the point of view of the public, and MPs do have some responsibility for this, is a lot of the things around this country that need changing or fixing, they are big long-term projects like health or transport that take 5, 10, 15 years. I mean, look at HS2, for instance. So the government will be making all of these announcements about the direction of policy, how they intend to spend money. But I think there's also this kind of recognition that they need to temper expectations, that waiting lists are not immediately going to come down, that the trains aren't going to suddenly all run on time, the rivers aren't going to be cleared up immediately. So certainly they'll be making all these big announcements that we're going to do this. But a little bit like we were talking about Boris Johnson and Brexit in 2019, really trying to make sure that they're not overselling themselves, that, yeah, we're going to fix this and it's all going to happen immediately, because the public will react badly if it then doesn't.
Thank you both so much for shedding a lot of light onto what is going to happen around the general election, because it hasn't, it's not always an easy thing to understand. But thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Research Reimagined podcast by Nottingham Trent University. For all of the latest news from the research community at NTU, follow us on Twitter at NTU_research, or sign up to our research newsletter by visiting ntu.ac.uk/research. Thanks for listening.